So we're going to start today with the first presentation by Jason Jackson. We will move on to the presentation by Indiana Minto Coy. Then we move to the presentation, the third presentation, Patterns of CARICOM, Return Migration and Brain Circulation. That will be presented on behalf of the presenter you see there by Jessica Jones. And the fourth presentation, Brain Circulation and the Financial Services Industry, Canada and the Caribbean as a Case Study, will be presented on behalf of the presenters by Dr. Keith Nurse. Just to say that this is an IDRC-funded project conducted by the Sridhar Rampal Center of the UWI. We will give the presenters, because we are running short on time, the same amount of time allotted, but I suspect the question and answer session will be a little truncated. So bear with me, and those of you who have questions, make them very succinct so that we move quickly through the sessions. I now invite the first presenter to make his presentation.
Good morning, everyone. Well, good afternoon, I guess, now, everybody. Thanks very much for the introduction. Okay, so I will go right into my presentation, given that we are a bit short on time. And as you can see, the title of the presentation is The Role of Caribbean Diasporas in Regional Science, Technology, and Innovation. And as our chair indicated, this is part of this paper, as well as the others on this panel, are part of a broader research project that tries to think more widely about diasporas and the potential role of diasporas within the Caribbean. We had a guiding question that framed the research broadly within this research project, and that's central to my paper. And that question is, how can source countries, and by source countries we mean countries that tend to be largely exporters of skilled labor, how can source countries exploit the benefits of brain circulation? And by brain circulation, what we mean is, whereas normally we think about the departure of skilled labor from, in particular, developing countries as a type of brain drain, the term brain circulation is designed to give a wider conception of how these skills can actually be used. That is, that perhaps persons don't just leave, but instead, the ways in which that they can contribute to development in their home countries. And this can be through a variety of ways, including return, as well as facilitating a variety of knowledge flows. And I'll talk a bit more about this as I go along. So in my presentation, I focus on the role of diasporas in science, technology, and innovation policy, with a particular attention to technology-intensive development. So we could start by thinking, what's the overall problem? And our keynote speaker earlier in the opening session, I think, provided the perfect framework by which I can enter into my presentation. That is, we can start to think about what are the developmental problems that face us in the region. And some of these problems I would suggest are, for example, weak economic performance. We face a competitiveness challenge, that is, we not only face low growth rates in most of our countries, but in particular, the goods and services that we produce have been facing increasingly higher and higher challenges on global markets. This, of course, is most apparent with traditional goods, for example, bananas out of St. Lucia. But the same can be said for many of our other products that we rely on the region. Tourism, for example, which itself faces a number of competitiveness challenges. And so therefore, there are all these areas where we can think about where we can apply science and technology to assist in boosting our competitiveness levels, again, as our keynote speaker indicated earlier this morning. So within the context of this heightened global competition, as well as high levels of Caribbean brain drain, we ask ourselves, can scientific diasporas play a role? And just to presage the entire presentation, where I focus is on biotechnology in Jamaica. And in particular, what I try to think about is the extent to which there are particular models that can be used to facilitate interactions between persons in the diaspora, so scientists and technologists in the diaspora, in particular in the area of biotechnology, and their colleagues and counterparts back in the region. And the focus that I take is on Jamaica. Okay, so the Caribbean competitiveness crisis. Economies face insufficient employment opportunities as well as low incomes. So we have low incomes, high unemployment, and limited employment opportunities. Again, to reiterate our keynote speaker from this morning, part of the challenge is not only to think about increasing educational output, but ensuring that persons either have jobs or that we provide them with the tools such that they can become successful entrepreneurs. So in this respect, the problem that I put forward is a microeconomic problem rather than a macroeconomic problem, which is what we hear about most of the times in the region. That is macroeconomics focusing on our debt levels, fiscal deficits, and so forth. Instead, what I suggest is that we think about our narrow productive sectors or focus on one or two industry areas, such as tourism or the traditional industries, and the extent to which we can try to boost other areas, manufacturing, for example, which has been suffering since the 1980s and early 1990s, as well as other areas of services. So part of the challenge that we face in the region then becomes, if we can no longer rely on traditional areas, and even if some of our newer areas like tourism and offshore finance and so forth are facing increasing competitiveness challenges globally, what then should our new activities be? That is, how do we determine what new areas of activities to enter? This has at least two components. One component is first, how do we acquire the types of skills, knowledge, and so forth, capabilities that would be necessary to be successful in new areas? And secondly, within the context of thinking about diaspora and the high rates of skilled out-migration that we see from the region, we can ask ourselves the question, can scientific diasporas play a role? Now, a critical context within which we can think about this issue of skilled migration is within a wider global political economy of migration. And what do I mean by this? Essentially that when we see high rates of out-migration, particularly skilled out-migration from developing countries to the advanced industrialized countries, this is not by accident. There are at least two important components. Now, one component is the obvious one, which is that there's high demand in the industrialized country, there are higher wages and so forth. Therefore, skilled migrants are attracted to taking advantage of these higher wages and opportunities which exist in industrialized countries. However, there's another side to this as well, and that side is that migration policy in rich countries is specifically designed to attract skilled migrants from developing countries. That is, industrialized countries recognize the importance of skilled migration. They recognize that they need more and more skilled migrants in order to boost their own growth rates and expand their own economies, and therefore they target skilled migrants from developing countries such as ours here in the region. So we can look at some data on this, for example. So first we see data on migration rates to the United States by level of educational attainment. We see very high rates of migration in tertiary levels from a number of key source countries. So if you look at the left-sided column in red, for example, from the Philippines, 844,000 tertiary level educated migrants. Of course, lots of health migrants. Similarly, from India, 668,000. Again, one of the key areas that we see in Indian high-skilled migration over the last 20 or 30 years began in health with doctors, and then much more recently in the IT sector. Now, some data you can see a little bit better, I think, perhaps in the back. Now, if we start to think about what are the countries that are the big exporters of skilled migrants, if we look on the left side, what we see are immigration stocks. That is, actual numbers of persons who migrate from given countries. And what do we see are the leading countries? Well, at the top, we see the United Kingdom, very interestingly. Lots of migrants going in other parts of Europe as well as the United States. The Philippines. Oh, thanks. India, Mexico, Germany, and so forth. So on one hand, we see what? Big countries, which makes sense. So we see big countries with large numbers of migrants that are going to other countries, skilled migrants. However, if we look to the right side and we start to think about immigration rates, that is, the stock of migrants over the populations of their source countries, we see a completely different picture, with entirely different countries becoming important. And what countries do we see? Guyana, Grenada, Jamaica, with immigration rates, and again, these are skilled migrants, tertiary-level educated migrants, migration rates of 89% in Guyana, 85% in Grenada, Similarly in Jamaica, 84% in St. Vincent, and so forth. Even Trinidad and Tobago, 79%. So whereas the highest numbers, the highest stock, actual numbers of migrants come from big countries, what we see is that small developing countries, such as ours in the region, actually suffer the most in terms of the high rates. That is, most of our migrants are actually going overseas. And again, as I suggested, much of this is driven by actual policies that rich countries put into place to attract these migrants, which of course raises the question of how can we ourselves design policies that will attract these migrants and take advantage of these skills that we have in our diasporas. Okay, so what's the theoretical framework I've used to think about this work? So again, we heard again in our keynote speech this morning the idea of national innovation systems. By national innovation systems, effectively what we mean are the interaction between the policy sector, so government, business, and the research sector, primarily universities. And the case that I talk about will be biotechnology in Jamaica. So a national innovation system, the system reflects institutional interactions between economic agents, so between persons located in these different sectors, the public sector, the research sector, and the private sector. So firms, research organizations, research research labs. So again, we talked about the importance of R&D in fostering the types of technology-intensive development that was necessary in the region, as well as other supportive areas, risk capital. So again, in our keynote speech, we heard about the importance of actually having finance available to foster some of these types of activities, and the extent to which our financial sector in the region, while well-developed, is very conservative. So again, there's a depiction of a national innovation system with the interactions between the university level, business, government, and research labs, where we get scientific research leading to technology development and ultimately product commercialization. I'll skip this in the interest of time. So when we start to think about diasporas and the role that they can play in this type of science and technology intensive development, what we realize is that in fact, diasporas and the movement of skilled persons has always been an important component of development. In fact, going back to the Industrial Revolution in countries like the United States and Germany, what we see is that a huge role was actually played by skilled migrants in that time, so in the 1800s, particularly from the United Kingdom. So you had technologists, engineers, and so forth who left the UK and went to these other countries, and one of the key things that they brought was knowledge about new products and processes. So for example, during this time, new processes, for example, around the processing of cotton in the textile industry, which in almost all countries is the most important industry in facilitating early industrialization. In Japan, in the late 19th and early 20th century, again, we see a similarly important role for skilled migrants, both Japanese migrants who went out to places like Germany, the United States, and the UK, as well as skilled persons from those countries who came into Japan, again, bringing this type of knowledge that was very important for building industry in the Japanese case. More recently, in the 20th century, from around the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, in countries like Korea and Taiwan, again, we see the importance of skilled migration, as I'll get to in a moment. So if you think about the Taiwanese case, which we can consider in some detail, in Taiwan, around the 1960s, as Taiwanese policymakers tried to plan how they would boost development in their country. One of the key things that policymakers did was to travel to Silicon Valley. So this is to California, where the early computer hardware industry was developing. And they had numerous interactions with overseas Taiwanese who were resident there. That is, engineers and scientists who were already in California, already in this emerging cluster of high technology, who were working. And essentially what they requested from these engineers and scientists was essentially policy advice. That is, how can we start to think about how we can develop our own high technology sectors in Taiwan? And what this dynamic led to essentially was a fostering of interactions, knowledge sharing, learning between policymakers on one hand and scientists and researchers on the other. So again, very similar to the idea we see of national innovation systems, where we see these institutional interactions between different agents sharing knowledge and information with a focused goal in mind. What did this lead to? At first, it was just a lot of knowledge sharing, but increasingly, as the Taiwanese government was able to build up an electronics sector, we started to see persons coming back. that is migrants, Taiwanese migrants who are in the United States, increasingly returning to Taiwan to invest, work for companies, and start their own companies in this emerging Taiwanese electronics sector. And at first it was very slow. So at first we had these conversations in the 1960s and the 1970s. Then by the 1980s, with the development of a science park called Hsinchu, we started to see people coming back. At first, just a few migrants. In the 1980s, less than 10 returnees per year. But by the 1990s, it was up to around an average of around 350 returnees per year, such that by 2000, a total of 5,025 returnees were working just in this science park in Taiwan. And half of this total had advanced degrees, meaning PhDs. All tertiary educated, half with PhDs. And in fact, this dynamic was so successful that 39% of the businesses in this science park were actually started by these returnees. So we see them both working in existing organizations and existing firms, as well as behaving entrepreneurially. And Taiwan, as we all know, is now one of the leading countries in electronics manufacturing. So again, this just highlights the potential role of diasporas in this particular case, and brings us to the question of how can diasporas then become, can play a similar role in the Caribbean context? So the work that I've done basically focuses on biotechnology in Jamaica. Biotechnology was chosen for a couple of reasons. First, there's a well-established core of researchers in biotechnology in Jamaica, primarily at the University of the West Indies Mona Campus. And second, government has long been interested in biotechnology, in particular agricultural biotechnology, feeding into, for example, trying to control certain diseases in key export products and so forth. And what I found was, whereas there had been attempts in the past for scientists in Mona, in particular, so in the biotechnology center in Mona, so scientists broadly within Jamaica to interact with their colleagues overseas, what they found was there was a lack of what we refer to as an institutional model to guide their interactions. So what do we mean by this? So similarly in the Taiwanese case, where we saw that through experiments and efforts, policymakers were able to gain information and share information with members of the private sector, researchers in the Silicon Valley case, and to do so successfully, such that they could bring back this information to Taiwan. And also there was similar information sharing between researchers in both the Taiwanese case and in the US. In biotechnology in Jamaica, by contrast, whereas there have been efforts, there have been a number of problems which have arisen. Problems such as who takes the lead on certain research projects? How do we share research findings? How do we deal with the different elements having to do with finance and so forth? And one of the key things which was notable in this case was what I refer to as the absence of a triple helix. That is, whereas we had these interactions between researchers, government was largely absent. And one of the problems, therefore, was a lack of an overarching guiding hand to facilitate some of these interactions. So there were many attempts, but most ended up in failure due to this lack of appropriate model. And this, unfortunately, has led to increased frustration between researchers who would like to work together, who see the potential benefits, both for their research as well as the industry more broadly, but nevertheless face these problems. The other important thing that we found is that there was a disconnect with industry. That is, these researchers in particular were not interested in just doing research for research sake. So they saw potential for commercial application of much of the work that they were doing. Nevertheless, they found the private sector to be largely unresponsive. And again, some of the reasons that were put forward for this were, for example, the extent to which there was the private sector was very conservative, a buy and sell mentality, much more interested in trading than in producing. And therefore, this led to challenges in showing how the outputs that are coming from the research sites or from the university could actually play a role in actual business. I mean, there are some exceptions to this rule. For example, Jamaica Broilers, which is a big poultry company in Jamaica, has in the past utilized inputs from the science community, so from the university. But these tend to be a bit more of the exception to the rule. And in fact, what was also interesting is that in cases where major companies from Jamaica found that in their day-to-day workings they needed what we can call scientific solutions, rather than searching for those solutions domestically, in many cases they'd go abroad, places like the United States and Canada, even though the solutions to those challenges could probably have been found from within their domestic research sector. So this reflected a low confidence on the part of the science low confidence in the science community on the part of the private sector. So again, if we think about the context of a national innovation system, what was missing is the proper interactions between these different areas, research, private sector, and government, in order to deal with some of these challenges. So just a final note, just to close, this research that I've been doing began early in this year. It's at its late stages now. There's a few more steps. So I'll stop there and look forward to your questions, comments, and suggestions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. We move straight into the next presentation. Presenter, Indiana Minto Coy.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay. Now, I'll be looking at telecommunications and the diaspora, which is contrary to the description you have in your agenda. Telecommunications, when we're talking about the diaspora and the diaspora-home relationship, telecommunications isn't always one of the natural points that comes to mind in that discussion. In fact, most research on the diaspora tends to ignore the role of telecommunications in the diaspora-home relationship. And the focus tends to be on remittances, and understandably so, given the role that remittances play throughout the world, and particularly in the case of the Caribbean. But what I'm proposing here today is that telecommunications has a significant role to play in this relationship between the diaspora and its home country for a number of reasons. Firstly, telecommunications, it's essentially the biggest machine, the world's largest machine. It handles and has the capacity to handle trade, to facilitate trade, as well as to be the item that's traded. Telecommunications in the context of the Caribbean, it has always represented a significant market. And within, you know, Jason just outlined a number of problems that the Caribbean currently faces. Within those problems and within the context of the region's search for new ways of igniting and tapping into the resources of its diaspora, then telecommunications has a huge role, huge and largely untapped role to play in this regard. So my presentation today is on the role of telecommunications in facilitating and extending the diaspora's contribution to the Caribbean. And some of the presentations that will come later this afternoon as well will deal with financial services and tourism. And within all that, telecommunications has a significant role to play here. So my presentation essentially, I'll go through a little of the background to kind of detail to you the current state of telecommunications in the Caribbean. And then I'll speak a little directly to the relationship with the diaspora in the Caribbean context. I'll discuss the current state of engagement and then speak a little to some of the challenges or barriers that have been faced here. My research, well, essentially started July of this year, so I'm still very much in the process of researching and collecting data. So some of the findings here are pretty tentative, but so far I've carried out a number of investigations, questionnaires and interviews with a number of people based in the Caribbean as well as in some of the diaspora markets. Okay, so the current state of telecommunications in the Caribbean. like the rest of the world, we've experienced, and the Caribbean that I speak of here is mainly CARICOM countries, as well as the Dominican Republic and Cuba and Haiti. So like the rest of the world, we've experienced liberalization and regulatory reform, mainly within the last two decades in the region. And with these twin processes, we've seen greater competition in telecommunication services. We've had lower prices. We've had increased access and choice in terms of providers, price plans. As an example, in 1999 in Jamaica, there was one price plan for mobile telecommunications. By 2001, there were actually seven price plans. So this is just an example of how industry reform has led to increased choice. And this increased choice and lower prices is not just for Caribbean nationals based within the region, but also for those who are outside connecting with their friends, their relatives, business associates in the region. We've also seen an emergence of e-commerce, e-government, and e- and mobile banking. There's also been increased investment and jobs. We've also seen telecommunications featuring increasingly in risk management and disaster preparedness in the Caribbean. For example, one of the major mobile providers, Digicel, actually allows messages to be sent on its network to let people know when disasters will strike, to let people know where are the essential hurricane shelters and so on. So what's also emerged is that quite a few countries, in fact, most countries in the Caribbean have actually developed national ICT strategies, with telecommunications being a significant part of that. And this movement is essentially an acknowledgement of the role of telecommunications and ICTs generally in development and the potential that exists here. So pre-2000, for the Commonwealth Caribbean particularly, you could say what existed was a monopoly dominated by cable and wireless. And though the region, in terms of size, was one of its smallest markets in terms of the number of countries and people, it actually accounted for a huge portion of cable and wireless's international revenues. So pre-2000, cable and wireless dominated the market. Post-2000, we've seen where a number of players have entered the markets of the different countries, and the competition in most cases we have fully liberalized regimes, and it continues there as well. And we've seen where Digicel has emerged as one of the significant competitors. But one of the interesting things to note here as well is that the main players are large international firms, not many local firms, and particularly those sponsored by the diaspora can be found in the region's markets. But despite the fact that we don't have many local firms, one of the benefits that liberalization and regulatory reform have brought us is that we've improved somewhat. We're not at the bottom in terms of international indicators. So that's the international ITU's ICT development index, which essentially looks at skills use of ICTs. And so the Caribbean generally fares in the middle. Of course, we have the extremes of Haiti, which there is ranked at 136. So while we've seen some developments and while we've benefited in terms of prices and so on, the investments have largely been in mobile services. And this is an important point as well, because then speaking about telecommunications and the diaspora, then this bodes well in terms of the potential which exists for entrepreneurs to tap into this market. Rates are still relatively high. national and regional divide in ICT. So in terms of access locally within countries, there's an urban-rural divide in terms of access to telecommunications and ICTs. Of course, mobile telephony has helped to allay that somewhat, but it's still a problem. And then there's the regional divide in terms of access. Of course, there's need for more competition, education, and investments. And as I mentioned before, the market is dominated largely by external and actors. But overall, the region hasn't fully taken advantage of the benefits that could be had from a more liberalized telecoms regime. Now, in terms of the direct relationship between telecoms and the diaspora in the Caribbean context, it's a historical relationship in terms of the value of the communication sector to the region. And this goes back to the colonial days where from 1878, for example, we had communications network in Jamaica. And this was mainly driven by the value of the region in England's global trade. So telecommunications has essentially enabled and facilitated our transnational relationships. And this comes up to the present with our diaspora as well. Now, interesting enough, as I had mentioned, the main share of cable and wireless's profits came from international telecoms. And in the case of Jamaica, which was cable and wireless's most significant market, in 1988, the international segment accounted for $252 million plus, while domestic only accounted for $68.7 million. And this is services, international service versus domestic service. And in the 90s, the international market actually accounted for roughly 80% of cable and wireless's profits. And this the value of this international market meant that cross-subsidization, which is essentially using the profits from the international market to deflate the local prices. So we had some of the lowest rates in the world simply because of the strength of that international market. And one author actually notes that in 1993, Jamaica received more calls from the US, and I think another country was Australia, even though we're smaller. And this essentially they've put down to the strength of the diaspora market, because So essentially this has been put down to the strength of the international market, with the diaspora being a significant part of that market. So in essence, the diaspora has been somewhat of a silent partner throughout the region's history in terms of the development of its communications industry. And in so doing, it has indirectly helped to provide jobs, vital foreign exchange. It's been a contributor in terms of trade, because through that international market, we've been a net exporter, which is a significant point as well. In terms of the value of and the relationship or the link between the diaspora and telecommunications, we see where that has been a feature of the region's history, and an area that still remains to be tapped into, especially now with more liberalized regimes. Now, what are the current ways in which the diaspora engages with the region, and what role or how does telecoms feature in this relationship? So one of the main ways is that telecommunications has actually helped to reduce the distance between home and abroad, so the diaspora can participate more. They feel more at home by calling easier, lower prices to get frequent updates on developments at home. An interesting case in Jamaica as well, and Jamaica is one of my main case studies, a Jamaica National, which is a credit union in Jamaica, has actually started. It has a huge portion of its shareholders existing outside of the region in the diaspora markets in the US, UK, and Canada. And one of the things that it's actually started doing is allow those to participate in its annual general meetings by phoning in, by Skype. And so we see this as an emerging way in which the telecommunications and ICTs broadly can actually help in reducing the distance and forging those links between the home and the diaspora. Another area is in the services. For example, there is e-government and e-commerce. So the diaspora can now pay bills and taxes online. They can order and pay for government services. So this reduces the need to travel to the region to carry out business as they previously had to do. And this, of course, has significant implications as it regards compliance, formality, and the reduction of the size of the informal sector, as well as the fact that so many of our nationals who reside abroad are also landowners locally. So this allows them to contribute to pay their taxes and contribute to governments in more effective ways. There is also opportunities for topping up mobile phones. So now the diaspora can actually top up the phones of their relatives that are based within the region. And they can also keep their mobile phones active, whereas previously they would lose that service if they didn't have the opportunity to top up. Roaming services, and in some cases we now have dual SIM cards, as in Suriname. Telecoms also is being used to facilitate the virtual presence of the diaspora in the region. And this is through the establishment of businesses that are not necessarily, as previously, have to be based in one location or the other. There's also the intersection with financial services, as can be seen in the area of mobile banking. A few financial institutions within the region have begun moving in this direction, including First Caribbean Bank. It has the potential and has actually been doing this, increasing the efficiency of traditional means of engagement between the diaspora and home. So no longer do people have to necessarily go into a banking institution or to find out if remittances have been sent. They can get SMS, which states that their remittances have arrived, and also they can send remittances remotely. Now, there are also opportunities for investment, call centers, virtual businesses. And so the idea from this is that telecommunications is not only a facilitator, an enabler of trade, but it is also a commodity that can be traded as well. So there are firms that are actually allowing others to have businesses virtually. Disaster relief and management, and we see that again in the Haitian earthquake. Skills and knowledge transfer. Politics and local governance. And one instance of this quite recently in Jamaica, where the diaspora was quite active and vocal in the issue regarding Dodo's Coke. And so via calling in programs, newspaper articles and so on, they were quite vocal in getting the government to move or adding support and adding their voice to local dissent. But there are some challenges, and most of the persons that I've spoken with who are actually entrepreneurs within the diaspora who've tried to start telecoms companies locally, one of the main things that they've noted is that the politics, the corruption, and the lack of trust. You know, these are key issues in their ability to invest, their ability and their desire to invest in the region. And some have actually lost out, having started making the way to invest in the region, but for one reason or the other, couldn't move forward with their investments. In other instances, there was one person who I spoke with who actually made a link with Bell Canada and actually started making the way to transfer technology and skills, but government support was not there. And one of the rationale here was that telecoms wasn't necessarily a sexy issue. It's not necessarily a vote winner. One exception to this, I'd say, was in Jamaica in the late 90s, because this was one of the main issues on the political manifestos of both major political parties. So moving forward, I see my time is almost up. But moving forward, I think one of the things that the region needs to move towards is the issue of harmonized regulatory framework. And we've missed a few opportunities here. In the early days with cable and wireless, and then in the late 90s and early 2000, there was the argument that the region should move forward in liberalization by adopting a joint approach to cable and wireless. That didn't happen. Individual countries went their own way. It was suggested again in how we negotiated with Digicel. That didn't happen. We individuals went their own way. And so successive instances have been provided for us to adopt a regional approach, and in so doing, being a better negotiating position. And we haven't always gone that way. There are also opportunities in terms of the next generation services to value and to trade in cultural industries. So, for example, to offer ringtones of, you know, people are already downloading or local songs and so on over the internet, and they don't pay for it. So there are opportunities to trade these as ringtones to sell or concerts and sporting events and so on. And I think key to this is that the region needs to become a producer and an exporter of content and infrastructure, and not just a consumer. So it's all about us becoming more proactive and active players in the market. Of course, there's still a lot of room for increasing e-government and e-service, distance learning and health services. And key to this is viewing the diaspora as a vital resource in helping the region to take advantage of the terms of international trade agreements. So the diaspora exists as a market, an influential voice externally that has not been used by national and regional governments, particularly when we're negotiating trade agreements. So finally, some conclusions. And these are early days yet. The main use or the main interface between the diaspora and the home as it regards telecommunications is in terms of social communication. And one of the arguments here is that there's still not an awareness and enough of an acceptance of the value of telecommunications as a tradable commodity. There's a need for deepening engagement via telecoms, and this has significant implications, again, for exports and sustainability in the Caribbean. And these are considerable, you know, considerations in the face of declining protections, declining competitiveness of our products, and the increasing search for means of diversifying and strengthening regional economies suggests that these types of relationships bode well in terms of their capacity to offer to the region new sources, new avenues for income, new ways of tapping into the resources of its diaspora for the development of the region. So forging development partnerships as well between the diaspora and the home, this is key to meeting the region's obligations internationally and locally. And this is as it relates to, you know, issues like the meeting or obligations on the Millennium Development Goals, and to moving towards a knowledge society, which our Caribbean leaders speak of so much, but have yet to make significant moves towards this. Thank you very much.
I would make two comments. And one of them is an appeal to Dr. Nils, who is heading this project. The fact that you restrict your research to case studies based on places like Jamaica, etc., prevents you from having a comparative sort of approach to your research. And in the Eastern Caribbean, we have done a lot collectively in terms of liberalization of telecoms, and I think that it is one of the things that we should ask your students to look at seriously when, even if they're doing case studies, with some kind of comparison with the Eastern Caribbean, because we have moved forward a lot in that regard. And in the last couple of years, the Eastern Caribbean has taken a lot of steps with regard to engaging its diaspora. And a lot of things have been done. In St. Lucia, for example, in July, we had something called a homecoming, where we had more than 1,000 people from the diaspora in St. Lucia talking about how we're going to move forward with the development of St. Lucia. And things like the transfer of knowledge becomes very important, because the cost of transfer of knowledge is one of the things that we discussed. And we also looked at issues such as removing remittances from being barrel inputs into the countries to real serious investment. So coming out of these discussions, we're now looking at something called a Global Development Fund for St. Lucia, sponsored by the diaspora. So there are a number of initiatives coming out of our region that I think that you really should take note of within your research, and I think that will really enrich the kinds of products that you come up with in the end, and the research and students come up with in the end.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is really a presentation of a paper done by Chantal Blois from the Center for Trade Policy and Law with the University of Carleton, with her research assistant Priyanka Devnath. Unfortunately, Chantal could not make it, and so I'm going to take up the mantle and present her research findings for her. I think I'm in a good position to present the findings because I'm the project manager for the IDRC project that all four papers are being written under. In terms of questions, please feel free to ask at the end. If I can, I will answer, or perhaps Dr. Nurse may be able to. If not, we'll take the questions back and make sure that Chantal gets back in touch with you to provide an answer. All right, I'll start off. They're looking at brain circulation. It's a case study of Caribbean nurses. They went through and did a fairly comprehensive review of the literature available on brain circulation of health professionals. And the study itself focuses in on Caribbean nurses. So what they did was to assemble the existing data on migration and brain circulation of Caribbean nurses, reviewed existing policy frameworks for managing migration and facilitating brain circulation. The research highlights a number of findings relevant to devising strategies for the region to maximize the positive development impact of migration whilst minimizing the negative consequences. Am I? All right, I think I'm good. Key problem to address is really the shortage of nurses. If you look at the available data, it highlights that for most Caribbean countries, there is a real shortage of nurses. In 2008, demand for nurses outweighed supply with approximately 30% of all approved positions for nurses remaining vacant. The ratio of nurses migrating compared to the remaining stock of about 7,800 in the Caribbean region is unparalleled in the world. 2,700 vacancies, 30% of all approved positions for nurses remain vacant. This shortage does not have only one cause, but out-migration of nurses is seen as a key factor. All right, let me just go back to good old The majority of Caribbean-trained nurses are migrating to work in the OECD countries, especially United States, Canada, and the UK. In terms of the figures, this, you'll see that the three main destinations, you have about 21,500 nurses in total, and broken down amongst Canada, UK, and the US, with the US taking the bulk of them. So again, we have a situation of, and Jason spoke to it in his first, in the first presentation, when he looked at more, in more detail of the amount of skilled and trained people that leave the Caribbean on a yearly basis. In terms of the policy options for managed migration of Caribbean nurses, what they found was that many scholars, while they discussed the potential benefits of return migration and brain circulation, really provide empirical evidence about the benefits and about the level of brain circulation. There is, again, the study that Jason made use of in his presentation by Dokier and Marfouk. It's a very detailed study where they go in and they give levels of brain drain across several countries. But one of the difficulties, as Chantal and Priyanka themselves realized when they were doing this study, is that it can be very, very difficult to get data for the Caribbean, and it can be very difficult to get data for sensitive subjects. So for example, when they sent out the questionnaires initially for the study, there was a significant resistance from the organizations that they sent them to in terms of passing the studies on to the individual nurses, and thereby getting access to full data. However, a number of policy options are available to facilitate brain circulation in terms of managing migration for nurses. There's a managed migration project in the Caribbean that I'm going to speak about a bit more in detail. And then there's also the new WHO Code of Practice and Negotiations of Temporary Labor Agreements, which are two of the promising policy options for this, for that purpose. In terms of the managed migration program for the Caribbean, this has been the most significant in terms of addressing the supply and demand conditions of nurses in the region. The program is currently underfunded, but offers great possibility as an instrument of public policy for harnessing the benefits of migration in the Caribbean, given the partners already involved. Focusing energy and resources in strengthening this mechanism while exploring ways to harness the potential of the WHO Code of Practice and Future Temporary Labor Arrangements is proposed by the authors as a key component of a managed migration strategy in health in the Caribbean. Now, if you look at the program itself, the key and interesting features, and perhaps what makes it work and what gives it the potential, is that it's a multilateral, cross-sector, interventional, long-term strategy for developing and maintaining an adequate supply of nurses in the region by increasing the intake, production, and retention of nurses. It originated out of the CARICOM Regional Nursing Body in 2001 in collaboration with a partnership with the Caribbean Nursing Organization and PAHO. There are two fundamental principles of the program. Nurses have the right as individuals to freedom of movement within and beyond the region, and that all people have the right to access high-quality services and programs. The program includes a Jamaican initiative, a St. Vincent initiative, and also the Homecoming program. I think that the key thing here is that with, I think, all migration, people will move. It is how you manage the movement and how you manage the mobility that is really the key and important factor at the end of the day. That is it in terms of their research. The only thing I'd like to add is that the research is ongoing. We have not yet put together the final findings. So any questions or comments that you have at the end, would definitely go a long way to informing the research itself. Thank you very much.
I now invite Dr. Les to make the final presentation.
Well, Jessica's seeing about the loading of the presentation, I maybe I can quickly explain the project and its goals and maybe address some of June's questions or comments. This is a project funded by the IDRC, and the goal was to look at, the project is entitled Strategic Opportunities in Caribbean Migration, with a focus on brain circulation and diasporic tourism and investment. And so this afternoon session, if I could do a little bit of a plug, is going to focus on the diasporic tourism component. What we're doing with the brain circulation area is to look at four sectors which are of critical importance to the Caribbean and for which the diasporas where the diaspora has played a critical role. So in that regard, we look at, as Jessica has indicated in her presentation, which she's doing on behalf of Chantal, we focus on the health sector, particularly nurses. We could have done doctors as well. And Jason is looking at the area of science and technology with a focus on biotechnology. And Indiana is looking at telecommunications with a focus on some of the critical areas and new dimensions of the telecommunications sector. And the last presentation, which is by Monique Moreau and Dominic Davis, is looking at the financial services sector in the Caribbean. And this is one of the studies where we're still in the field working on it. So I'll briefly go through some of the key elements of what we're doing and what are some of the initial findings. But just to answer June's question, because when we start presenting the findings, people ask, so what about my country or what about my region? The project is focused in the brain circulation area on looking at sectors. And so whichever countries show up as critical elements of the equation for that particular sector, then that's what gets covered. So it's not a country focus per se in this study. So when you're talking about telecoms, you know, some countries jump out at you because of the earnings and the rates and the level of investments just tend to be higher. But we also had to cull some of what we were doing because, for example, if you're looking at the issue of nurses, almost every Caribbean territory is affected by it. But we all know that particularly Jamaica is so much in the vanguard of the diasporic phenomenon that Jamaica is an obvious case study that applies to many of the areas that we're looking at. And then there's the issue of availability of data. In the OECS territories in particular, the data availability is quite weak. And so when we were choosing countries to look at or zero in on, most OECS territories did not factor in to the equation, unfortunately. Where we do, when we come to talk about the diaspora tourism, you'll also see the rationale for our choice of countries. We look at Jamaica, Dominican Republic, two very large tourism destinations, but countries which have very large diasporas. And you'll be even quite startled, I think, by the data. And then we look at Suriname and Guyana, which are really small tourism economies, but the size of their diaspora relative to the domestic population is huge. And so the diasporic tourism impact is quite significant. So again, that's a rationale for the choice of countries and sectors and so forth. But this is only just the beginning. I've been trying to sell this project as a research project for 7 years now. And we only got a bite from the International Development Research Center 2 years ago. So there's a lot of work to be done. So we welcome the opportunity to do work in the OECS territories. Just show us the money, and we will come. We are very entrepreneurial at the University of West Indies in our new dispensation. I'll talk a little bit about the brain circulation in financial sector now. The financial services sector is really important to the region. Often it's defined purely in terms of a notion that the firms that move into the region to take advantage of the tax treaties and so forth in our region, and that's definitely the case in Barbados. And we've chosen to look in part at the relationship between Barbados and Canada. Why? The international financial services sector, or what they call the international business sector in Barbados, is the largest tax contributor. It contributes more to the coffers of Barbados and the government of Barbados than the tourism sector. Right? So this is the largest cash cow for the Barbados government and for the Barbados economy. And somewhere between 35 to 40% of all the firms operating in Barbados under the international business sector are Canadian firms. So the relationship between Canada and Barbados was something that we wanted to really highlight in the research. The other key thing is that Canadian banks have been in operation in the region since the late 19th century. And Canadian banks have a significant profile throughout the region. Their share of the market, of the Caribbean market, again, there's no clear data on it, but it's quite significant in most territories. And so the relationship between Canada and the Caribbean, broadly speaking, is a well-developed one. Canadian banks have done quite well in the global economic recession. Their conservative banking policies have averted the kind of meltdown we've seen in other countries and so forth. So the relationship between Canadian banks and the region, again, is proven to be a critical issue here. The second element of the research project, which is the area where we are only now moving into, is looking at the relationship between the remittance companies as a financial service sector and the way in which it flows into the brain circulation phenomenon. And what we do know is that the big companies like Western Union and MoneyGram dominate the market space, but in a few countries, we have a number of remittance companies that have emerged, or partnerships between remittance companies from the Caribbean and the big firms that are taking advantage of this growth. Now, on a per capita basis, and in terms of GDP terms, the Caribbean has some of the highest remittances per capita and remittances per GDP. Several territories are in the top 10. So Jamaica, Dominican Republic, and some of the smaller economies like Grenada, St. Lucia, etc., are all in the top 10. And so remittances looms large. And in the international literature, there's been much discussion about bringing down the cost of remittance transactions and so forth. But we are not focused on that element. We are actually more interested in how can our firms participate in this huge area of growth in the financial services sector. And so there's a case of Grace Kennedy in Jamaica. They have a partnership with Western Union since 2002, I think it is. And it's been recently renewed for another 10 years. And through Grace Kennedy, they are operating in several territories outside of Jamaica. So they're in Trinidad and Tobago, they're in Barbados, they're in most of the OECS territories, Guyana, and so on. And so there is a direct linkage, in this case, through a joint venture, where a Caribbean firm is participating in the growth of this financial services activity. And so we're looking at that area and how more Caribbean firms can participate. There's the example of Guyana, where La Parkan, which is, I describe La Parkan as the quintessential diasporic firm. Because when I was a student studying in Canada and I wanted to ship back my goods to Trinidad and Tobago, La Parkan was the obvious choice of a freighting company. Back then, they were only a freighting company. They're now the largest freighting company, private-owned freighting company throughout the region. But they've diversified beyond that. They have a remittance company, which is the second largest remittance company in Guyana after Western Union. And so you can see that as a specific example. And Lopakhin has actually moved on beyond that. Lopakhin is estimated, with all of its activities and economic firms involved, to be the second largest employer in Guyana after the government. And so you can see this is a critical example of how the diasporic economy is becoming very much the key driver of the Caribbean economy. The third example I want to use is how, in the case of Suriname, you have the emergence of remittance companies like SuriChange, which has outlets all over the Netherlands, and they've dominated. So Western Union and MoneyGram and so on didn't target the Surinamese economy. And so what you have is a scenario where local firms were able to move into that market and dominate that market, whereas the international firms weren't as much interested. And so maybe there is some benefit to being a little bit isolated from the global economy. But when you go to Dominican, to Suriname, and then you go to places like global cities like Amsterdam and so on, the impact that and the ways in which firms from Suriname are able to capture or take advantage of the diaspora economy is quite significant. Indiana mentioned, and I'll talk a bit about it in the diaspora tourism, the telecoms incumbent in Suriname, Telesur, is not only offering dual SIM cards both in Suriname and in the Netherlands. They're also diversifying the operations to target mobile minutes as currency. And so they're now moving beyond looking at the transfer of cash resources to using minutes as a currency to move between the two locations. And so what we are seeing is a dynamic environment whereby we're seeing the intersection between a number of activities. So telecoms is linking into financial services, is linking into the role of ICTs, is linking into diasporic tourism, et cetera, et cetera. I'm gonna end my comments for now, because I know we are running out of time. But just to indicate that financial services needs to be broadened in most of our understanding. When you go to most of our government agencies to talk to them about things like financial services or telecoms and whatever, they see them in very narrow silos. And the way in which the global economy is moving, there's a lot of convergence of various sectors. And I think some Caribbean entrepreneurs have already understood this phenomenon. I think we need our governments and other key agencies to catch up with some of our enterprising innovations coming from our private sector. So I want to end on that note. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you can see. I would like to thank the presenters, and we move straight into the question and answer session. We have two mics at the back. So if you have a question, you raise your hand and the mic will be brought to you. I'd like to take five questions at one sitting. We take five questions and we allow the presenters to answer these questions, and we will do another round of questions after that. So we have one question.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Karen Roberts-Kasmali. I'm an MPhil student at the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine campus. Now, I did my master's thesis in diaspora, ICTs, and knowledge transfer. Now, one of the things I was said to me in terms of when I was doing my research, I interviewed an executive at the International Labor Organization because I was inquiring in terms of the use of ICTs to tap into our diasporic, the skills, so that it could be transferred into the homeland. And one of the things the person said to me is that do not assume that because we have, there's the availability of a large diasporic population that has the skills, knowledge, the innovations, even the entrepreneurship residing in that bunch, do not assume for one moment that they will make themselves available for the type of development that we are talking about that goes beyond remittances. So within all the papers, I heard a theme, overarching theme of engaging our diasporic population. How then do we go about doing that, knowing fully well that some of them may not want to be engaged at the level that we may want to engage them? Thank you.
Another question. Nobody else? Well, our question is on engagement of the diaspora, and I know that it's not an easy question having to deal with the diaspora myself, so let me see if I can get some answers from you. Yeah. Go ahead.
Thanks, I'll start. That's one of the points that I had in the presentation. I didn't refer to it specifically, but in this research as well, I'm also looking at the capacity and willingness and desire of the diaspora to engage with the region, because it's not to be assumed, you know, as you noted, that they're willing to do so. And in fact, some of the persons that I've spoken with are from the diaspora, and many from Dominica. So I've looked at the OECS region. But what they noted, one, the digital divide not only exists in the Caribbean, but it also exists in the diaspora market. So in countries like Canada, for example, you'll find that migrants tend not always to have access to investment capital or to technology as others. So that's the first point. I think that the second one is based on my discussion with quite a few people, and the majority of them from Canada, from the Dominica diaspora. They noted that, and this is one thing that I found interesting, just an aside, that so many people I met from Dominica are involved in telecoms in Canada. But quite a few of them have tried to start businesses in the region. So there is a core group that has the interest, has the networks, the skills, and the desire to invest in the region, to help the region's government. One of the things, in one case, this person was actually requested to do a massive research on the role of the diaspora and how telecoms can feature in this. They did the research, sent the data back to the person in the country within the Caribbean who requested it, and that was it. In another instance, the contact was made between Bell Canada and this particular country, and then the minister shifted, and then that was it. So in a lot of cases, so it's not one way, and in a lot of cases, it's about the level of interest within the region, the level of willingness among our region's leaders to innovate, and as Keith had mentioned, to see the linkages between telecoms and other sectors, and not just to see these as isolated issues, because they're all connected, and particularly when we talk about moving into the information age, and making telecoms a more significant contributor to our region's economies, then our leaders also have to play a role in, let's say, accepting that telecoms has a more diverse role to play in our future development.
Anybody else?
So I'll just add to those comments. I mean, I also think it's a very good question, a really good point. This assumption that may seem to be in the world that the diaspora always wants to be engaged. I think there are two things that we can think about. First, I think in many country examples, just in the Caribbean, it's quite clear from, for example, the extent to which members of the diaspora engage with their embassies and consulates in particular. In some of these source countries, so in Canada, in the United States, so in New York, for example, in Toronto, and so forth, that there's a lot of interest within the diaspora, both in the way that they engage with the extent to which they engage with their consulates and embassies, as well as some of the self-organization that's taking place in some of these countries. So the extent to which you have lots of diaspora organizations that have emerged organically, not being led by anything that's happening in the home country. So on one hand, this does give us some indication that there is a lot of interest within the diaspora to try to engage and to try to become more actively involved at a number of levels, at developmental levels, political levels in many cases, and so forth in their home countries. However, on the other hand, on the other side, what I think this point also speaks to is the importance from a policy standpoint of putting in place the appropriate incentives to encourage members of the diaspora to engage in some of these areas that we've pointed out here. So for example, ICTs, science or technology intensive areas, finance, and so forth. Because whereas many persons in the diaspora may want to get engaged, it's certainly the case that many others may not. And they may not want to because they face various frustrations, they think nothing is happening on the policy side, or that government is an impediment rather than a facilitator. They may just not have as much knowledge of what is taking place in the region in many cases. So I think from a policy standpoint, there's also an important role of providing information and incentives in order to facilitate these types of flows and activities.
Okay, first of all, let's say a theoretical level, a historical level. What we do know is this. The economies that are on a growth trajectory have very little difficulty attracting their diasporas to come back and invest. Why? Because in many of the OECD countries where people have migrated to, there tends to be a glass ceiling, okay? Which is that the point at which, beyond which many of our young, bright people can't go. They can't get jobs beyond a certain point because of all kinds of reasons. This is of race, ethnicity, you name it. And so what you find, and this is what we've noted in literature and also seen in the Caribbean context, is that professionals reach a certain point in their own livelihoods when it's an attractive option to think about investing back home or investing in a location for which there are strong kinship ties or for where there's the possibility for all kinds of leveraging of resources and community building. So we see that in the case of Latin America with what we call hometown associations. And increasingly we're seeing it in terms of strategic kinds of investments in commercial areas and so forth. I can give you, several anecdotal examples from the research that we've been looking at. Piece of La Parca, all of the entrepreneurs were studying in Canada at first, and then they moved back to Guyana. So that's a classic example of this brain circulation activity. Now, when we conceptualize brain circulation as a construct, it's not just the movement of people, meaning like human migrants. We're also looking at the movement of resources, the movement of skills, the movement of intellectual property, networking, advocacy. So in some instances, people don't even have to move. The example I can give from, let's say, Suriname. A number of Surinamese doctors that are based in the Netherlands have just recently established a care hotel. And I'll talk more about that in my presentation this afternoon. But they've set up a care hotel in Suriname targeted at the diaspora, utilizing the cheaper cost of operating in Paramaribo, as opposed to offering those same services to a diaspora community in the Netherlands, and it's funded through insurance and all those kinds of things. And there are other examples I can point to of top people in many of our firms in the region who studied abroad, lived abroad, and have returned. And that's a classic example of brain circulation. I mean, I could count tons of my friends. We all studied abroad, we worked abroad, and we're back in the region, and we keep going back and forth. And so the concept of what we've spoken about is transmigration. There's no fixity to it. There's no one destination. There's multiple destinations. It's really, quintessential global citizenry we're talking about. Global middle-class people are moving all around the world. They're connected in all kinds of ways, and this is the target group that we're looking at in this research project. And so, yes, it's a very good question. How do we ensure that this engagement actually happens? Or what we're trying to do is just measure what exists. Because in many respects, we've been operating with very little empirical information about this. There are lots of agencies who have been arguing that
that brain circulation is alive and well, that there's something called brain gain. But when you start asking, well, so where's the evidence? There's precious little. So what we're trying to do with this project is just amass the existing data and information on these flows and patterns and to come up with some kind of theoretical and strategic way of how we can possibly expand this engagement process. So that's just a response. This is a really good question. Thank you very much.
I'd like to add that working in the area, not just looking at the theories and the research, that we tend to think that because people have kinship ties to our region, that they will just automatically come, you know? But remember that these people are also investors, and we must put things in place to attract investors. We tend to treat our people differently to other investors. So when we have to look at investment, we have to look at these policies seriously for us to be able to attract people. The other thing that we have not spoken about, we seem to limit ourselves here to talking about like a St. Lucia diaspora coming in and investing in St. Lucia. But one of the things that I have realized working in this area is that a lot of different diasporas are interested in investing in St. Lucia, not just a St. Lucia diaspora. So it's one of the things that we have to look at, how a Jamaican diaspora, for example, would invest there, and they have already started doing it because of the business climate in St. Lucia. So you also have to look at that dimension of it. We have other questions.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Samantha Joseph from the Department of Economics, University of the West Indies. And I have had the opportunity to carry some research on diaspora. I've actually interviewed over a couple of 300 to 400 members of the diaspora, 42 diaspora associations in the US, Canada, the UK. I've studied embassies from the various countries. And I think the problem is not that the members of the Caribbean diaspora, they're not willing to contribute, or they're not willing to participate, or they're not willing to help develop their economies. But it's a matter of the lack of communication, a lack of incentive by the respective shareholders in these respective countries. And if you ask a diaspora association, have you been contacted by the government or by any stakeholder in your home country with regards to investment opportunities? They will tell you no. And they will tell you that they are willing to contribute to their home country, even via knowledge transfer and skill transfer, via the use of the internet, by giving classes, virtual classes. And so I do not think it's an issue of them not wanting to. I think it's an issue of them not knowing, the lack of information of what they can do to contribute to their region, and also the lack of the incentive by the respective government, by the respective stakeholders in the home country to the members of the diaspora. So that was a contribution to the question she asked, and that would also support the need for telecommunication to make the members of the diaspora aware of what is going on in the home country, as well as the need in the home country, because they're across in the host country, they're not aware what is needed in the home country, they're not aware of the opportunities in the home country. So there's a gap that exists between there. So I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
I would like to, if you all are not responding, I'd like to note that point, but to say that it works both ways, that the people who are interested in investing in countries usually come and find out what the opportunities are. Governments, it's the onus is also on governments and the private sector in the countries to also make that information available, but I think that it works both ways. So sometimes I think that our diasporas expect us to reach out to them a little more than we would to other investors, and to do a little more because they are citizens of our countries, and so we have to go the extra mile for them.
Veronica Simon, UWI Open Campus, St. Lucia. I want to take the discussion a little further because I'm interested in the nuts and bolts of how we, address this whole thing. And there's been a lot of emphasis on government and what government can do and in reaching out to the diaspora, etc. But I think that we have overlooked a very key sector, and that would be our private sector in the various regions. and what is it that is in place for the private sector to be able to access the kind of expertise which obviously exists in the diaspora and which they often are either unaware of or unwilling to access, etc. For example, is there a comprehensive database of the types of expertise, cataloging, categorizing, and so on, of the types of expertise resident in the various diasporas? And if I, as a manufacturer or anybody in private enterprise, wants to access that expertise, what is my route? How do I go about doing this?
Take another question.
Mm-hmm. Because
we just have 5 more minutes.
Just to plug from here, draw from here, another sector that may be important to look at and maybe a question, in terms of population age index, in the Asian population, one of the dynamics is net migration. And we find that within the last couple of years and years to come, we trust that people who have retired are coming back home and they are investing. I was just coming up from the Armand and recognize most of the land there have been bought by people who are not even solutions, but people who have migrated here. And Brian, what are you, let me put it this way, are you looking at the elderly in terms of their migration, how they can plug in and create more entrepreneurship, more business, and of course more financial support to our Caribbean?
Any other question?
Yes, my name is Jennifer Rouse. I come also from Trinidad, from the Ministry of the People and Social Development. I too was going to make a comment too on the aging population that is now throughout the Caribbean, but not from that angle. I'm also looking at it from the standpoint of the political culture and how that is affected by an aging population, and as a result of which could be one of the reasons that Dr. Lin Choi is her name? Koi, in part of your beyond remittances, as part of your challenge, because of this particular component of the population aging, you would find that there is a subtle fear of that digital divide and making those connections. I mean, even wanting to know, even having a desire. But yet there is a paradox where that in a lot of the people in the business community, private sector, government or notwithstanding, who are in the leadership positions and decision-making capacities are aged. Most of them in those areas are over 50. So it is a question of them doing same-o in the style that they have been accustomed to and their parents, and then having this digital divide, which is a whole new dynamic coming into play within an aging population that is now cutting across all the islands. So I think we have to look at it both ways and from what Dr. Nile said as well.
Question?
Mary Wilfred, UNDP St. Lucia. The first question I want to ask is whether the term brain drain is gradually becoming obsolete to be replaced with brain circulation. The second question is to Jason, who spoke on the issue of the model in Jamaica. You spoke of the lack of institutional model for diaspora engagement. I would like to ask whether the managed migration for the nurses is an example of that institutional model, and whether, based on some of your preliminary findings of other institutions that may parallel to what the Caribbean nurses are doing. Thank you.
Final question.
Yeah, Mrs. Singh, Ministry of Education, St. Lucia. The demand for nurses outweighs the supply by about 30%. But we need to continue supplying nurses. But the stats are showing that the number of students opting to do the sciences is not that exciting. So how can we maintain that supply if that trend continues you know, we have a lot of our nurses moving mainly to the US. And my second question, the first presenters mentioned about the Taiwanese model, which is a good model. Over a period of time, you had an increase of diaspora return in investing. How many Caribbean countries are actually following that model up to date, and how active or how proactive they are in following that initiative by the Taiwanese government? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will start with the first presenter, Jason.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the questions. I'll give a quick response to maybe the first one, which was about the database. Many countries globally, particularly developing countries and some transition countries, have attempted to put together diaspora databases, specifically capturing these types of skills. Most of them have run into a lot of difficulties over time. That said, the Jamaican government now, I think led by the consulate in New York, as I understand it, is again attempting something similar to this, which is to put together a database of skills in the diaspora. So lots of governments have been interested in doing this and have tried, but there have been various challenges along the way, but there are definitely current efforts going on in the Caribbean. I know Jamaica for sure, and I know other countries in the region are also interested as well. Secondly, the managed migration program. So I think in some respects it could inform the types of dynamics which I think would be important and useful in science and technology. However, it only captures some parts. So I mean, as I understand, the managed migration program has more to do with managing the flows of nurses out of the country and so forth. Whereas I think in the what we are thinking about in terms of science and technology is perhaps a bit broader. Broader meaning that it doesn't necessarily have to do with the physical movement of persons who are scientists and technologists and so forth, rather facilitating ways in which they can interact with each other to share ideas and so forth. So I think there is something to be gained, but then we also think a little bit in the science and technology field a bit more broadly about knowledge sharing, technology transfer, knowledge transfer, and so forth. And then finally, the Taiwanese example, unfortunately, I think the answer is no. I don't think, again, specifically in areas like science and technology, that there are any countries, any governments in the region that are trying to do something like this. Now, many governments in the region are trying to do other things around migrant populations, levels of diaspora engagement, and so forth. Again, in Jamaica, the Jamaica Diaspora Conference is a very good example of ways in which the government is actively trying to engage with diaspora communities and so forth, in particular through some of the types of diaspora organizations that have been mentioned. However, in these more narrow areas of industry, particularly where we can start to think about how the private sector can get engaged in these types of areas, I think there's much less, unfortunately, there's much less activity in the Caribbean. So I'll leave it at that.
In terms of the first question regarding the role of the private sector, I think most of the cases that we've mentioned throughout the presentations haven't been initiatives that have been started by governments, but it's actually the private sector, particularly in financial services, who've been involved in engaging the diaspora. In terms of the existing initiatives to capture the skills, the resources of the diaspora, the Jamaican diaspora, as was just mentioned, the Jamaican government is currently undertaking an initiative like that. It's funded by the EU. They've started in the UK, and the idea is to roll this project out to the US and Canada. One of the problems that they're facing is getting the diaspora themselves to trust the government to give them their details about things like incomes, their skills level, where they work, their address. So there are a lot of issues about protection of things, about privacy and who will have access to this data. The diaspora in Dominica, DAS, Dominica Association of Sciences, or Science Academy, they've actually been one of the first ones to attempt this from, I think, the early 2000s, to actually map the different skills and resources within the diaspora. So they have that online, they have that resource online now. Barbados is also now trying to do a similar project, and one of the things which is quite innovative that they've done as well is to offer free tickets to people who log in and register their details within a particular time frame. So there's something that the diaspora is getting from providing this information. But beyond that, there are quite a few companies within the region who currently do business in the diaspora market. They are active in those markets. They are aware of the resources in those markets. And I go back again to Jamaica National, to Grace Kennedy. They are active in the diaspora markets. They know the resources that are there. So in terms of wanting to access capacity or knowledge or some sort of expertise, there is that ability to do that if they're that willing to do it. I thank you for that point about the digital divide relating to age as well. One of the points that I had mentioned in the presentation was that perhaps with the exception of Jamaica in the late 90s, most governments haven't been that active in moving forward to reform their telecommunication sector. And one of the reasons for Jamaica being a pioneer in that sense is because of the minister of telecommunications at that point, who was a young lawyer, and he had his background was actually the Fair Trade Commission in Jamaica. So he came from that background having a knowledge of the value of telecommunications, a sense of the value of competition in reducing prices. And so when he became the Minister of Industry, Trade and Commerce with responsibility for telecommunications, he had intimate knowledge of what was possible and what could happen. Of course, it wasn't him alone, but he came about at a point where there were other factors around him that consolidated that support to reform the telecommunication sector. So that's a major point. I think that's it. Thank you.
End of it.
Yeah, I don't think there's much more to add, except that the question was asked, is brain drain an obsolete concept? And the answer is, well, no, it's still alive and well. The region we have the highest brain drain rates in the world. Countries like Guyana and Suriname top the list. It's still a critical factor. And it really relates to, I think the point that was being made earlier by Professor Sankat, is that the absorptive capacity in our economies to take our tertiary educated people is very low. So unless we begin to transform our economies, these brain drain rates are going to continue, given all the estimations and projections for the demand for labor, and particularly skilled labor in certain sectors in the OECD countries, and their demographic transitions and problems that they're having. So brain drain and brain circulation and brain gain and brain waste are all interconnected and related. There's not one replacing the other. So you do have brain drain rates, and you're now talking about the possibility, how can we tap into the opportunities from moving investment and resources and intellectual property between these communities. And then there's brain waste. There are lots of people who have PhDs driving taxi in North America and Europe from all parts of the developing world. So all of these things are coexisting at the same time. For us though, the real issue at hand is, how can we make this part of a broader, what I call the Caribbean diasporic economy, and be more strategic about it, and grow both the economies in the Caribbean and the economies of our diaspora communities? Because if their economy isn't growing, meaning their share of income and investment in their new host societies, if that's not growing, then it's unlikely they will have the capacity to invest back in the region, and vice versa. So it has to be viewed beyond the silos of countries, to look at a broader construct of
what I've been calling in recent times the Caribbean diasporic economy. So thank you very much.
I would like to thank the presenters for speaking with us this morning. One thing that is clearer to me is that engagement of the diaspora means that we must also put our house in order at home for us to be able to attract our own people to invest in our countries. Earlier, I threw a question out to Dr. Nurse, and he came back with a response which did not satisfy me. Unfortunately, Dr. Nurse, and I will be persistent, because I find, since I was a student at UWE many years ago, a lot of the research has been concentrated on certain CARICOM countries, and much to the detriment of the OECS. And as the ambassador to OECS, I'd like to appeal again to the university to put some effort into research on these countries. Research is about finding out things that are not, you cannot easily find out. So if, I mean, this would be a great opportunity. And one of the reasons why I made the appeal was because of the young lady who presented on ICT. And there's a book that came out about 2 weeks ago called Small States, Small Solutions, Improving Connectivity and Increasing the Effectiveness of Public Services. And that book is written primarily on the OECS, and it's a study done by the World Bank. So there is information that is available if we go and look for the information. So I would like to make that appeal, acknowledging all of the limitations that Dr. Nurse noted. So thank you again.